Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today's episode was actually prompted by an email from a listener. Thanks to all those who do email in. We'll mention the email address at the end of the show. But we do read all the emails and they're really useful and helpful in prompting us to think of new things to talk about. And this email comes from a doctor and he says this. Hello, I'm a resident doctor hoping to specialise in anaesthetics, something I've avoided so far in my medical career, but will inevitably be confronted with as an anaesthetic trainee is exposure to abortion, the termination of pregnancy list that requires an anaesthetist. My opinions on abortion itself, I think, align with yours. Hence, I would not feel comfortable as an obstetrics and gynaecology doctor performing an abortion or prescribing a medical abortion. However, I'd love to know your thoughts on what Christians ought to do as we become more and more removed from the procedure itself. Is it wrong to be the anaesthetist in the theatre, where I do not perform the procedure, but I very much aid and abet its completion? Does it matter that my focus is exclusively on care of the mother and not her fetus? How about the porter who wheels the patient to the theatre? How about the colleague who checks her blood pressure in the day treatment unit? How about the person who manufactured the cannula? Clearly, they don't make cannulas for abortion and cannulas for everything else, so there must become a point at which the causal link is broken. Just because Hitler ate a loaf of bread doesn't make the baker complicit in the Holocaust. But perhaps if the baker knew the destiny of that particular loaf and did nothing to stop it, does that maybe matter? The obvious and simple answer is to claim my right to conscientious objection and to be asked to be kept away from the termination of pregnancy list. However, it occurs to me that it'd be very easy for all Christian healthcare staff to distance themselves entirely from these women and so create a totally godless environment. If that isn't necessary, then we can continue to surround these women with Christian love and grace. If you have any thoughts or wisdom to share on this, I would be most grateful.
Yeah, so it's a great letter. Thanks very much for sending it. And it does raise very obvious questions for all Christians, not just in healthcare, but really anyone working inside some kind of secular organization, even participating in society, where all of us in different ways involved or cooperating with evil.
Yes. And the classic example people often give here is just the act of paying your taxes, a proportion of that money that you pay to, in this country, you know, HMRC, the tax agency, is then given to the government, and maybe a small fraction of that will be spent on things that we as Christians might find morally objectionable.
Absolutely right. And there are huge numbers of Christian people and people of other faiths working within the NHS. And yet there are some things that the NHS is doing that we may feel uncomfortable with. And so to what extent is just the very fact that we are choosing to be employed by this vast monolithic organization, are we colluding with some of the things that we're not happy about?
Mm. So how would you begin to answer our listener's question as the trainee anaesthetist? Where should he draw the line?
Well, I think the first thing to recognise is that this is not at all a new problem. It's a problem, in fact, which Christians have been wrestling with right back to the very beginning of the faith. And therefore, we can even see in the person of Jesus and in the apostles and so on, examples of where they are attempting to live a godly life and live lives which are following godly principles, but which are recognizing the reality of evil that's around us. And I think it starts first by recognizing that this is not a new problem. This is something that Christians have always been faced with. And second, that we need to have a more sophisticated and nuanced understanding of the nature of evil than perhaps sometimes we have.
What do you mean by that last point?
Well, I think that it's possible to have a kind of Sunday school view of good and evil that is all to do with things that we have done. And some things are good and some things are bad, and we shouldn't do bad things and we should only do good things. And provided we only do good things, then everything is fine. You know, and there's a very clear distinction between what is bad and what is good.
And I guess that kind of cookie cutter version of ethics and morality really fails to grapple with the way our lives are deeply interconnected with other human beings and their moral choices, and the institutions that those human beings have built, riddled and shot through with their moral choices, and the way that we don't just live as these autonomized islands of virtue or vice, but we are actually caught up in everyone else's choices and morality.
Yeah, and of course, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is a fundamental truth that there are some actions which are clearly evil.
The Ten Commandments gives us a helpful list.
Yeah, and you know, that it's also to do with our intentions, you know, to deliberately decide to do something that you know is evil, and then to do it, to choose to do it. That is clearly part of being a moral being, being morally accountable for our actions. And it's part of the dignity of being human, being held accountable for our choices and our actions. So we certainly don't want to lose that understanding. But as you say, part of it is to do with the fact that we all live in these very complex mixes of society where other people's actions are influence the choices we have, and we are all to some extent involved in the actions of others. And it's interesting, you do see this, for instance, in the way that the prophets, don't you, the Old Testament prophets, identify with the people, even though they themselves have not been personally guilty betraying God. They say, we have failed God. They identify with the corporate guilt and the evil of the people.
Yeah. And I think sometimes particularly kind of Protestant minded evangelicals struggle with the idea of corporate guilt or corporate sin, and would prefer or more comfortable with the more individualistic notion that, you know, God just treats us as individuals and we each have to only account for our own actions. But I would suggest that that's not really consonant with the Old Testament and the New Testament, how it understands sin and evil.
Absolutely right. But it's not only that there is involvement with other human beings and other evil choices, but also evil has this mysterious tendency to infiltrate beyond into the very structures of society. So there is such a thing as structural evil. There are unjust systems. There are human powers that have become corrupt and embody a kind of evil systems. And of course, again, there's a very obvious biblical example of this in the way that the biblical writers talk about Babylon. As this the city of evil, and particularly, you know, in the Revelation where of John in the last book of the Bible, Babylon becomes a whole system which is devoted of evil power and influence.
The kind of the polar opposite of the New Jerusalem, this city of purity and goodness and light, is this, as you say, this system, this man-made oppositional force. And you even see it right at the beginning of the Bible. You see in the Garden of Eden, in Genesis 3, Adam and Eve, the humans clearly make bad moral choices, sinful choices. They disobey God's command. But there's also a third character. There's the serpent, a mysterious personification of evil, potentially Satan, not really sure, but clearly a sign in the kind of poetic, polemical language of that early bits of Genesis, that evil is not simply residing in human hearts, but also has some kind of exterior existence as well.
Absolutely right. So you not only have, as you put it, you not only got these human structures, but you have these mysterious principalities and powers, the forces of evil in the heavenly places, and which you know the New Testament writers take extremely seriously, and they we've talked about this in a previous podcast. They have this concept that these invisible spiritual forces of evil are somehow in lockstep with human powers. Mm. They accentuate and amplify human weakness and human brokenness.
Yeah, and people kind of have a degree of choice to the extent to which they open themselves up to be used by and complicit and cooperate with that evil, or the extent to which they seek to resist that. And you know, you have, you know, lots of biblical language in the New Testament about, you know, keeping in step with the spirit rather than, you know, allowing yourself to be opened up to evil. And but at the same time, it's not, there is also this, as we say, this kind of third force, this there's a sense of evil that can exist beyond simply the fallen choices of human people, and we can either resist it or we can walk in step with it.
Yes. So to summarize all that, you know, we have this extraordinarily complex, nuanced, interlocking understanding of evil. And I do think that this is one of the remarkable gifts that Christian theology and a Christian biblical understanding of the world has to give to the rest of society, because it's very striking to me how simplistic and monochromatic the understandings of evil often are within secular circles. I mean, you know, just going off at a bit of a tangent, but the Silicon Valley and the tech bros, you know, they can't avoid the reality that bad things seem to happen to when their technology is unleashed. But by and large, it's all just dismissed as a sort of small group of, quote, bad actors. You know, most people are fundamentally decent and honest and moral, but for some unaccountable reason, there are a few rogue bad actors out there, and they do bad things, and we've got to try and resist them. But it's a remarkably simplistic and a naive understanding of the reality of evil.
I think you're right. I think there is this kind of cartoonish goodies and baddies. Bad people do bad things, good people do good things. Nothing else to it. And then every so often there's a kind of cataclysmic shattering event which pulls the wool from our eyes and makes people start to wrestle with evil more perceptively. And I think the classic example that comes to mind would be the Second World War, and in particular the understanding after the war had finished, the growing understanding of the Holocaust. And there was a sense in which, fine, Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, Himmler, these are all just like irredeemable monsters, nothing to like us, you know, they're just baddies, and what can you do? But the recognition that the Holocaust was a kind of an industrialized genocide machine in which there were hundreds of thousands of quote unquote ordinary Germans who were involved, whether they were driving the trains that took the Jews to Auschwitz, or they were, you know, emptying the crematorium in the concentration camps, or even they were just kind of citizen bystanders who lived nearby and did nothing to help the Jews in their society. There's a sense in which, hang on, they can't all be evil. I mean, it's not like Germany could be this kind of uniquely evil country compared to everyone else, which maintains its kind of 95% good, 5% bad ratio. So I think there was an attempt to kind of grapple briefly in the post-war era with a deeper understanding of what does it mean to be complicit in evil, but it doesn't last long. And I feel like it often lapses and people revert to this kind of cartoonish goodies and baddies version of morality.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And there was a deep pessimism after the Second World War. I think it was also encapsulated in a famous quote from Solzhenitsyn, that the line between good and evil passes through every human heart. Mm-hmm. It's a much more, again, sophisticated, nuanced understanding.
Christian understanding.
It's a Christian understanding, exactly. So I think that this is something we have to offer to the world, that we are not surprised by evil, that we understand it has its own forces, that it's something that has to be resisted, that it has subtlety and nuance, deceptive potential, and so on. And so, so sort of coming back to then this question, moral theologians over the centuries have often wrestled with this question, particularly in the Catholic tradition. where it's called the question of cooperation in evil or cooperation with evil. And I found that their reflections have been really quite interesting and helpful. And they start with the recognition that, as I said, you know, that everybody, even Jesus himself, had the question of cooperation with evil. And so it was Jesus who said, render to Caesar those things that are Caesar's, even though he knew perfectly well
what that money would be used for.
The horrors that the Roman state was up to, and the rampant cruelty and abuse of power. Mm. Another example which someone has pointed out to me, which I find very interesting, is Zacchaeus, the tax collector, who everybody knew that the tax collectors were collaborators.
Deeply corrupt as well.
They were corrupt. They were making huge amounts of money for themselves off the backs of the oppression. And so when Jesus sees Zacchaeus in the tree, he says, "I'm coming to your house for tea." He knows perfectly well what Zacchaeus's wealth has been based on. He doesn't say, "I'm not going to touch a morsel that your evil hands have produced."
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really powerful example. And it's helpful, isn't it, for people like our listener who wrote in, the training anaesthetist, to know that that these are questions that Christians have, as you say, wrestled with over the centuries, all the way back to the literal gospels, that these are moral dilemmas that they might, you know, the particularities of being an anaesthetist in the NHS as it performs abortions might be a relatively recent phenomenon, but actually Christ himself has some really helpful wisdom and, you know, lived out actions that we can attend to and learn from and reflect on to help us kind of navigate this. So I think clearly what we're saying is the idea that Christians must keep themselves utterly pure and totally isolated from anything which might be, however tangentially related to sin, is just clearly unsustainable in Christian ethics, given the examples of Jesus.
Yeah, unless you want to go and live in a completely isolated setup. And even then, you know, in a monastery or a Christian community, you are still in some way collaborating with the state. So the in the reflections, sorry. All right. As the moral theologians reflected on this, they came up with several criteria which to help to understand different degrees of cooperation with evil. And they in particular came up with three criteria which I found helpful. The first was between intentional and non-intentional cooperation. The second between active and passive cooperation, and the third between proximate and remote cooperation. And it might be worth just unpicking a bit those three criteria.
Okay, intentional and non-intentional. That seems fairly clear. That's a distinction between when you know what you're doing and you know that you're helping, you know, let's say, to use the example, if you're assisting the surgeon as they conduct the medical abortion, passing them the scalpel, that's intentional. You know what's going to happen. You know that you're cooperating with an act that you consider to be evil. Versus non-intentional would be the person in the factory who manufactured that scalpel and had no idea what it would be used for.
Yes, that's right. To what extent am I deliberately putting myself in this cooperative role, and to what extent is it being forced upon me? So that's the first distinction. We'll come back to then how one might apply it in practically. The second distinction is between active and passive, and it's related in some way, but active involvement is where my actions are actually contributing towards the evil, versus passive, where I'm simply allowing this to happen. So if I as a citizen pay my taxes, that would be a passive cooperation. But if I was involved in part of the state's action that was doing evil, that would be a more an active force of evil. And then the third one, which again is I think is very important, is how close are we, not just geographically, but causally? How close are my actions and my activity to the actual evil that is being forced, and or is this something that is really quite distant from my own activities and moral responsibilities?
So again, maybe an example of that would be the person who grew the wheat that was ultimately ground up and baked into a loaf of bread that was sold in a shop to someone who then took it to Hitler's bunker and it sustained Hitler as he planned the Holocaust. The person who grew the wheat is geographically, but also in the causal chain, very, very distant, very remote from the actual act of evil.
Whereas the
person who works in his kitchen every day in the bunker, feeding and meeting Hitler's needs, is much closer.
Exactly right. and so in the healthcare situation, the person who works in a hospital but is in a completely different department from the, for instance, where abortions are taking place, is very different from the person who's assisting in the procedure or who is closely involved within that department. So I think all of these three principles are helpful principles to try and disentangle. I mean, again, there are other factors which moral theologians have argued we should take into account. One of them is that we should think about what is the possible moral alternatives. You know, is there some other way that is open to me, where I don't cooperate with the evil? And then the other is to think about how might the evil be counterbalanced by good. Are there good things that come from my cooperation? Yes, in some way I am involved with evil, but good things come from it. And here, of course, the example would be Jesus and Zacchaeus. Yes, yeah. Jesus is collaborating with, in some sense, with Zacchaeus' activities, unintentionally and passively. But the wonderful gift of Jesus coming to tea and of the forgiveness and liberation and restoration that Zacchaeus is going to receive vastly outweighs the collaboration with evil.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've got a friend who's skeptical about Christianity? That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hand of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thank you to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures that content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And just as a slight tangent for a moment, I find this conversation really helpful in a social sense, because I think there's a lot of talk in recent years about this idea of complicity, and particularly in the kind of, you know, the woke turn, for lack of a better phrase. There was a lot of people, particularly on the kind of progressive or on the left side of politics, who got very engaged by this idea that it was vital not to be complicit in bad things. And even your inaction, your silence is violence. You know, this idea that if you weren't actively, to use an example from America, you know, actively working to dismantle white supremacy, you were no better than the KKK. And it was it's an example of this highly kind of black and white thinking that we talked about earlier, that there are goodies and baddies. You know, there's a famous theorist, Ibram Kendi, who kind of posits that every action is either racist or anti-racist. And if you are not taking anti-racist actions, by definition, you are taking racist, you are making racist actions, which, you know, I think is a very insufficient moral ethic and leads to a whole bunch of silliness. But it's really helpful to see that the Christian understanding of complicity is more rich. And it's not simply saying, well, if you helped paint the sign on a hospital that 30 years later was, you know, used to direct women towards a ward where there would be medical abortions carried out, you are complicit in evil. You know, actually, there is complicity is a grey area, is a spectrum. You can be complicit in different kinds of ways, and actions can have more than one moral outcome. They can be both good and bad, or a mixture of the two together. And I think. It's helpful for us to, because I think we instinctively, a lot of Christians, a lot of people find the kind of neo-Puritanism of some of the woke movement quite off-putting. But I think it's helpful to think through kind of philosophically and theologically why it is that their kind of quite radical idea of complicity is unhelpful.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't thought about for Tim, but you're absolutely right. It is a kind of analogue of this simplistic black and white, good and evil. It's interesting to speculate about where that comes from within this sort of progressive woke philosophy. How have they come to this goodies and baddies? I suspect a lot of it is related to Marxism, which, you know, this is a kind of neo-Marxist philosophy. It has a lot of roots in Marxism. And Marxism basically divides people into goodies and baddies. It's the revolutionaries and it's the bourgeoisie, and you're one or the other, and again, possibly it has a rather simplistic understanding of good and evil. But I was also just reflecting, Tim, and this is much more in your wheelhouse than mine, that this also has something about the safeguarding issues in the Church of England, doesn't it? Because is it not the same issue? To what extent is Justin Welby complicit with the bad things happening on his watch? Yeah. Was his cooperation with evil, was it proximate or distant? Was it intentional or unintentional? You could say that it was unintentional, that it was pretty distant.
Very distant, yeah.
And that it was passive and not active. And I think, you know, if one was to apply this kind of framework, you would say he was much less responsible and much less cooperating than many others.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really perceptive observation. And I think a lot of the kind of struggles of the Church of England in its current safeguarding crisis, again, revolve around this question of complicity. There's a sense of frustration and impotence because in many cases, the actual abusers are dead and beyond the reach of justice. And so there's a sense of pent up frustration, energy roiling around saying, well, we must find someone to blame. The consequences of this abuse were so horrendous, we cannot just throw up our hands and say, gosh, that was an evil person that had evil deeds. There must be other baddies that we can root out. And I think at its worst excesses, there are elements of the kind of desire to paint everyone as black and white. You're either on the side of the survivors and on the side of light and truth and goodness, or you are as bad as the paedophile, as the child abuser, as the sadist themselves. When, again, a truly Christian anthropology recognizes that all human beings are mixtures of good and evil. And that leads us to the shocking and the unpalatable conclusion that even a person like John Smythe, who beat hundreds of young men viciously until they bled in his garden shed, also wasn't pure evil, but there was something good about his life. He was still made in God's image. He still had some goodness somewhere. But also, as you say, that the idea that some of the other clergy who might have had fragmentary knowledge of what he did and didn't immediately pass on to the police or go and confront Smythe himself or whatever else, they made mistakes. They might be complicit to some extent, but we need to be careful about where we draw lines and to what degree we are kind of lumping people in together.
Yeah, so to come back to the question of the where our questioner started, what about in terms of where abortion procedures are embedded within the hospital? How do we respond as Christian healthcare professionals? And this is very close to home for me because I was working as a neonatologist, as a baby doctor in a big central London hospital. And as I've written about previously, just one floor away from the neonatal intensive care unit where we were trying to ensure the survival of premature babies was a fetal medicine unit, which we worked closely with our colleagues in the fetal medicine unit, knowing that they were involved from time to time in carrying out abortion procedures, sometimes late abortions or feticides, involving really quite mature fetuses or unborn babies. And on many occasions, I was being asked as a neonatologist to go one floor up to speak to a pregnant mother who had been offered the possibility of an abortion or a feticide because of some kind of fetal abnormality.
And some Christians might be surprised to hear that you were prepared to kind of be a link in the chain that might end in abortion. How did you work through the ethics and the morality of that in your own heart?
Well, it is something I wrestled with, trying to work out what my own individual calling was in this very complex and confusing situation. And I had some colleagues who were Christian doctors and who they had taken the decision that they felt it was inappropriate for them to be involved at all, that if an abortion was being considered, they would refuse to be involved in any way, to talk to the parents and so on. But after a certain amount of heart-searching, I felt that it was better that I was involved. This is where, again, one is balancing potential goods against the cooperation with evil. It was better that I was involved because I could put different perspectives to her from my perspective as a paediatrician, as with experience of caring for many disabled children and the impact on their families and so on. So I could actually give different perspectives, which came from my Christian position. So in terms of thinking about the grid, was this active or passive? Well, it was active in that I was actively choosing to discuss the possibility of abortion and so on. Was my cooperation intentional or unintentional? Well, certainly in terms of the abortion, it was unintentional. I wasn't intending that my involvement should lead to abortion. I was actually discussing the alternatives to abortion. Was it proximal or distant? Well, it was pretty proximal. I was closely involved. So using that kind of grid, you know, I come somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. But I felt in the end that my involvement positively was outweighed the collaboration that was going on. The abortion would happen anyway, if that was what the decision was, but by being involved in counselling, supporting, providing an alternative perspective, I felt that I was doing something that was positive and consistent with my Christian faith.
And I suppose it wasn't inconceivable that after talking to you, some of these mothers might actually change their minds and not go ahead with the abortion. So there might actually have been some lives saved.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, you know, at a human level, that's exactly what happened. That on several occasions, I remember a mother who had been intending to have an abortion changed her mind following a conversation. Not that I in any way was applying coercive pressure. It was simply laying out an alternative perspective. And particularly in cases where there was a lethal or limiting abnormality, a whole number of parents decided to continue the pregnancy, and we then provided palliative care for the baby after birth.
Mm. And I think that's a really critical point in this conversation around abortion, is that it's easy for those Christians who are opposed to abortion to lapse into kind of thinking that the mother and the parents of children who go for an abortion are kind of irredeemably evil, sinful. But actually, so much of this is part of the system and the culture that people live in, and the both that they grow up in, but then also the medical culture they're inserted into. And you know, that our listeners has had a question, you know, it would be easy for Christian healthcare staff to distance themselves, but that would create an entirely kind of godless environment. And I suspect, tell me if I'm wrong, but there's a tendency among doctors who are happy, who have no moral objections around late stage abortions, to be relatively negative about the reality of giving birth to a disabled child, either one who may soon die or one who will live a very challenged, limited life. And therefore, if that's the only message a woman hears, then of course she might feel there's no alternative but abortion. But actually, if you're able, and other Christians are able to say, well, there are actually other perspectives on disability, and I've actually cared for these children before, and I've met parents who've raised children in these circumstances, and actually there is a lot of joy and love and life to be found in there. It's not irredeemable. It's not all doom and gloom. You know, that's actually really helpful in helping confused, shocked, scared mothers kind of, who never planned to be in the situation, never wanted this, decide what to do.
Yeah, I think that's how I felt it, that it's right, and that our Christian calling therefore is not to try to keep ourselves completely untainted from involvement, but it's to follow our Lord, who, you know, is described as a friend of sinners and tax collectors and
prostitutes
and the
lepers.
Yeah. And yet he himself managed to live in with godliness and love and compassion. And of course this is a desperately challenging way for all of us, isn't it? It's not uniquely at all for Christian health practitioners, but we're called to try to find this way of living in a positive way, of recognizing that some cooperation with evil is inevitable, but doing it for God's glory.
And so to round off the response to our trainee anaesthetist, you know, obviously this is an individual personal decision. You talked about how other Christian doctors you knew drew a line slightly differently to yours and wouldn't be involved in counseling women ahead of an abortion. But if you were a trainee anaesthetist wrestling with this dilemma, how would you assess the cooperation with evil involved in providing anaesthetic care to a woman as she undergoes a surgical abortion?
Yeah, so if you use the same grid, you know, is it intentional or unintentional? I think it clearly is intentional. You know, by participating in this process that it's going to lead to abortion. You are assisting intentionally with it. Is it active or passive? Well, it seems to be it's active. You are actively providing an anaesthetic. And is it proximal or distant? Well, it's pretty proximal. You're not actually doing the abortion, but nonetheless, you are participating in the procedure. So from that point of view, the cooperation with evil is very close. What about the possible good things that can happen? Well, in theory, yes, a compassionate Christian anaesthetist might be able to make a difference. In reality, though, unlike the opportunity I had as a neonatologist, I could frequently block out 30 minutes or an hour for this conversation with a woman considering an abortion. I think in comparison, the anaesthetist often has a very brief, pretty transactional relationship with the person that they're about to anaesthetize. So I would think that generally the opportunities for genuine Christian involvement, care, compassion is pretty limited. So I think, again, this is a decision which everybody has to make for themselves. But I would think if I was in that position, I would make the decisions I couldn't in all conscience provide that anaesthesia, and I would seek to have the right of conscience. And actually, in the UK law, a doctor cannot be compelled to participate in the abortion procedure. So medics are fairly well protected by the law, although the position of nurses and midwives is much less clear.
Oh, that's interesting. And I suppose that's a particular carve out in the Abortion Act itself, and doesn't necessarily apply to other practices in healthcare that other Christians might object to. Most notably, as it's coming down the track, assisted dying.
That was exactly what I was going to say. That this at the moment, this has been a relatively localized issue for people only involved in gynecology, neonatology, obstetrics, and so on. But if assisted suicide is legalized and starts being practiced within the NHS, then this question of cooperation with evil could well impact many, many people, many Christians and people of other faiths, people of moral convictions, who suddenly ask themselves, if by being a member of a clinical team in which assisted suicide is being carried out, even if I personally am not involved, to what extent is it possible for me to continue to work as part of this clinical team?
Yeah, it's going to be a really challenging dilemma for a lot of believers. And just lastly, just there's also this idea of moral trauma, the idea that even if you could make your peace between you and God with your level of complicity in a procedure, and you think it doesn't kind of cross the line, is simply being involved in something which, you know, you believe is the intentional destruction of a human life, does it leave its own psychological, emotional, moral scars?
Yes, this is a concept which it's been around for a long time, but it's recently had much more airing in professional circles and in medical ethical circles, this concept of moral trauma. And the essence of it is that you are actively participating in something where something deeply traumatic and morally repugnant is happening, and where you feel in some way complicit. And it certainly is a reality where healthcare staff feel that they're participating with activities and procedures which they feel totally out of sympathy with, and they feel a wrong, and yet because of their position as a healthcare professional, they cannot avoid it. And there is evidence, certainly from jurisdictions in which euthanasia, various kinds of medical killing are carried out, there is evidence of long-lasting psychological, psychiatric symptoms, flashbacks, PTSD from health professionals who've been involved, and even from relatives who've been present in the room when a loved one has been effectively killed or committed suicide. You can imagine that could lead to long-lasting emotional and psychological consequences.
And there's an interesting, a lot of this talking about moral injury or moral trauma comes from the military as well, and increasing understanding of the prevalence of PTSD for soldiers who've been involved in combat. And then there's a sense that even if you believe in a macro sense the war you went to fight in was a just war, and you have no doubt that, you know, your actions to defeat Hitler in World War II were morally virtuous, simple, the fact of having to pull the trigger and see German soldiers fall dead at the hands of your actions, we know can cause significant psychological, emotional, moral harm. So it's really confusing to want to work, even if you think in a big picture sense this was a right thing to do, it can still have individual micro instances where actually I feel like I have been harmed, my ethics, my morality have been harmed by what I did.
Yes, but one of the concerning features of human nature is that the first time you do that, there's a huge emotional impact. By the time you've done it 20, 50, 100 times, we become adjusted, we adapt. And going back to the horrors of the Holocaust, no doubt those were the kind of psychological mechanisms that allow, and therefore there is real concern about the fact that if we're creating a new generation of doctors who will get used to killing, you know, what are we doing psychologically, and would the rest of us want to be looked after by a doctor who had become highly experienced in and desensitized to the act of killing?
And perhaps abortion is a cautionary tale there, in that there is a generations of doctors who've become incredibly blasé about what, you know, a medical abortion actually involves, which, without wanting to be gratuitous, is effectively dismembering a almost fully, if it's a late stage, dismembering an almost fully formed human being inside the womb and then sucking the bits out. I mean, and yet there are lots of ordinary loving family men and women who conduct that operation and have somehow over hundreds of repetitions have lost sight of the fact that the kind of moral injurious nature of what they're doing. They become morally desensitized to who that child was and is.
I'm afraid so. And again, you know, we recognize that we're talking about deeply painful topics, and many people listening may well have been personally influenced by this, and we want to do it in a sensitive way. But we want to recognize that that our human nature is vulnerable. Morally, we are often weak and capable of being malformed morally, and therefore protecting everyone from harm, from moral injury, and learning to navigate these complexities of what it means to try to follow Christ, to live a moral life in the midst of a deeply complex and a world which is penetrated with evil.
Yeah. And as we say, it's not just about trying to keep your own personal balance sheet as clean as possible. And, you know, we don't just try and avoid sinful acts because we think it will make God angry, but also because we understand that these things leave, you know, emotional, spiritual scars on ourselves. And obviously that none of that is to downplay the incredible scope for redemption and grace and mercy that every Christian understands and lives in. But at the same time, there is a kind of, well, there's a train of thought, isn't there, in scripture about we want to not just try and keep our copybook clean and unblotted so that we can go to heaven, but also because we want to become the kinds of people that we're created to be. And the more and more that we act in ways that fall short of God's ideal, the more and more it starts to change who we are and how we think.
Yes, and there is such a wonderful promise of forgiveness and liberation. All of us make mistakes. As I look back on decades that I worked within the NHS trying to navigate these complexities, I'm well aware of the fact that many times I got it wrong. Many times I fell into various failings and compromises and mistakes, and yet by God's grace we can know forgiveness and liberation, and that we can learn to live with wisdom, with joy, and with serenity in the midst of extraordinary complexities.
Definitely. All right, well, let's bring it to a close there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you so much to the trainee anaesthetist doctor who sent in that fascinating question that sparked this episode. We'd love to hear more thoughts, particularly real-life ethical challenges that you might be wrestling with in your own work or in your family life or in your culture and circumstances. But also, if you come across things you've found online or in the news that you think you'd love to hear us discuss, please do get in touch. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. There's lots more of Dad's thinking and writing on medical ethics, particularly for those who are Christians and working in healthcare, on his website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find out some more of my own writing, my journalism, at my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, do sign up for my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend. That's everything for this week. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.